Hello and welcome to this latest podcast of Fast Talkers, the 21st episode we've done. We've got a cracker lined up for you. I won't give too much away because I'll introduce all of our guests during the show, but I really hope you're enjoying these podcasts. Remember, you can subscribe, download, tell your friends, tweet, retweet, Insta, TikTok, whatever you want, but do pass on the word that we're doing these Fast Talkers podcasts. This was meant to be a Daniel Ricciardo special, but as you'll hear, we digress just a little bit. Enjoy. Hello and welcome to another week of Fast Talkers. Hopefully you're okay, your world is well. We have a great panel lined up to have a good old chat about motorsport, Formula One, and a bit of an Australia kind of Daniel Ricciardo special, and you'll see why in just a moment. So let me introduce you to our panel. First of all, we have ESPN journalist Nate Saunders. Nate, great to see you and your follically challenged head. How are you?
Hey Jenny, yeah, good to see you. Good to see some familiar faces as well. It's been so long since I think the four of us would have been in the same kind of place, you know. It's been a long time, but yeah, great to be here and thanks for having us on.
It's always a pleasure. Now, you do have a connection with Daniel Ricciardo, which is why I wanted to get you on. We will hold that thought for just a moment because I want to share it with the other guys. So let's go to our next panelist, who is F1 photographer extraordinaire Darren Heath. And Darren, it's a little bit dark where you are, but that's because you're on the other side of the world.
I'm in sunny Auckland, very dark Auckland right now, very quiet Auckland.
Amazing. And a place, obviously, that isn't struggling with coronavirus so much at the moment. Just reassure people, life will turn back to normal at some point, won't it?
It's something, absolutely, Jenny, that I say to my friends in the UK, who are so obviously down and depressed at the moment, that life does return to normal. We obviously are still aware of the pandemic and what's going on around the world and very vigilant about what's happening here. But yeah, we hug and we kiss and we go to bars and we go to cinemas and life does return to normal. It really does.
Do you find yourself just hugging and kissing random people because you can?
Random people, random guys, couriers come to the door and you're just all over them.
Finally on the panel is former executive of Jordan and Cosworth and a former colleague of mine, as well as Nate being a former colleague of mine as well. Mark Gallagher, hello to you. And
Hello, Jenny.
You're in Australia.
I am. I'm in, just like Darren, I'm in a COVID-free zone in South Australia, about an hour outside of Adelaide, a familiar Grand Prix venue from a few years ago where I met my wife back in 1991, hence I have a place here and came down 3 weeks ago, did my 2 weeks in mandatory quarantine in a hotel and then came out to normality, which is one of the most strange experiences I've ever had. I think the first waitress who walked up to me to take an order, I nearly jumped a mile because she was standing, you know, 1 foot away from me and I was like, ah. But yeah, it's weird. No masks, nothing, just a very simple check-in every time you go into a restaurant or a shop. Otherwise, it's normal.
Yeah. Not envious, are we, Nate, at all?
No, not at all. Oh. That sounds blissful. All of that from both guys just sounds amazing.
You have to, I don't know what Mark's experience is, but I have to be aware of that when speaking to friends at home or what you post on social media, because you're aware that you look like you're boasting, but you're not at all. You know, it's just the way it is.
Darren, do you find yourself, I'm suffering from survivor's guilt. You know, I'm out here kind of having a relaxed time. Went out for lunch today, you know, met a few friends.
I know what you mean. You know, it's especially just, if you watch international news, that's the problem.
Yeah, exactly. You go on, you watch the riots in Holland and then you see all the goings on in the UK and you think, oh my God, Europe, you know, is in a mess. Yeah. And we made a good strategy call, Darren. New Zealand and Australia.
We did. Yeah, that's true.
Well, we're going to try and pick people up with this show. So don't worry. We're now going into our own COVID bubble where we can talk about all sorts of things. As I said, we will talk about Daniel Ricciardo and what the possibilities are for him this year. Nate, you have a special relationship with Daniel Ricciardo. We'll come to that in a minute as well. But first of all, Mark, I wanted to come to you because we had the sad news this week that Adrian Campos has passed away. And I think you knew him fairly well, didn't you?
Yeah, I first met him when I was working in the media in Formula 3000. He came into 3000 in sort of 1985. 86, I think he'd finished quite well in the German F3 Championship. And weirdly, like Lewis Hamilton, Adrian Campos's career started in remote controlled car racing, but at the age of 20, can you believe? So at 20, he won the national championship in remote controlled car racing and then went into prop racing proper. And, you know, he had a pretty good career. He did a couple of years in Formula One with Minardi, but had a very unsuccessful run, loads of retirements. I think he only finished 3 Grand Prix in the 2 years that he did Formula One. He did a few other things, but then really came into his own running a team, and he ran Campos Racing. And I suppose where I next really touched on him, so to speak, Jenny, was when I went to Cosworth and he had won one of the franchises, the Campos Meta F1 team, had won one of the new franchises for the 2010 season. And I dealt with him over that sort of first winter when they were building their car. But sadly, he never actually got to even race because he ran out of money before the season even started. And so he sold the team on to other investors. And he was really, really disappointed. He had such a big dream of having a Spanish Formula One team. But then he went on to, you know, run GP3 and GP2. And frankly, at the age of 60, he's gone far too soon. And by all accounts, extremely unexpectedly.
Everybody says he was the most gentle, kindest man, and you don't find a huge amount of those in the motorsport world.
I mean, it's interesting. I was looking at the results of his team. I mean, I had a team in GP3, and we, you know, used to meet at team meetings and so on. And I sometimes felt that it was to his detriment that he was too nice a guy. So it's a very cutthroat business. And when you look at the results of his team, I'm not going to say Campos was a journeyman team. It wasn't a journeyman team. They give lots of drivers great opportunities, Fernando Alonso being one of them. But you always had the impression that he didn't have perhaps that final killer instinct, either as a driver or as a team owner. But he loved what he did. And there are a great many engineers, mechanics, drivers, people in motorsport who owe their career to Adrian Campos. And it's a really sad thing to have happened, and I say very unexpectedly.
But we did say we were going to try and lighten the mood, so I wanted to talk about follicles, hair follicles, more importantly. And this is a touchy subject, and some people are saying, why are you talking about this? It's the pictures of Sebastian Vettel, and they've been released by Aston Martin, of him having the first sort of fitting and seat fitting in the car. And Nate, you decided to take one of those pictures and repost it with a picture of yourself. Why?
First of all, I know you said I was on here for the Ricciardo book, but part of me thought, well, I think this is going to be a Vettel thing now as well, which I liked. So that picture was him in the car at the seat fitting, and it got my mind spinning. I was thinking, I've seen myself in that situation before, and I thought, that's ridiculous because I'm not an F1 driver. And I cast my mind back to 2017. I went to a Red Bull media event where we trained with Verstappen at a boxing ring, but there was a simulator there, and I was in the car kind of driving, and part of our video package that we ended up with was me looking exactly the same with exactly the same length hair as Vettel. So I just put a nice side by side who wore it better, and I think the consensus currently is that Vettel wore it much better than me. So so any chance that a pick me up in the middle of COVID is completely gone. I thought it was an interesting look, and it's funny because you don't often see F1 drivers like that. Usually, you know, we're used to seeing them with very healthy full head of hair, so I think that's why it got people talking. Certainly from my perspective, I thought, wow, that's different. You don't see that every day. And it reminded me of the first time I cut my hair short and thought, I've got a bit of a problem here now at the front of my head.
It reminds me, Nate, of, and I think it's almost a healthy thing in a way that in this obsessed with one's image, certain drivers we could mention, that it's refreshing to see someone who just, this is me. You know, I've lost some hair, or this is what my look is, for whatever reason. And it instantly made me think of people like Denny Hulme and those kind of the older drivers from the 60s and 70s, where they almost look much older than they were, you know, but there was less of a kind of, there was a more honest approach maybe to the way they looked, and just, I'm just here to drive.
I thought of Stirling Moss as well, was a good, you know, when you see him and he had, it was always thinning hair and just never at any point would you think someone like Stirling Moss would have ever cared about that. He was just like, no, this is who I am. I'm a racing driver. So yeah, I agree with you, Darren. I think it's nice to see that. And we'll see what happens in the season. I think it'll be like when Alonso grew his beard a few years ago. Everyone's going to be fascinated to see the next couple of steps of what happens with Vettel's hair from here.
Well, I I have my suspicions that he's had hair transplant surgery, which I have absolutely no problem with at all. I've got friends who've done it. One of those friends, a well-known photographer called Mark Tomo Thompson, has made no secret of the fact within the Formula One paddock that he's had it done. It's very successful. Got it done in Turkey, which is the place where apparently it's the best and the cheapest to go. That's no surprise for Tomo. And Vettel got wind of this, apparently, and spoke to Tomo during the season last year. And Tomo offered him a 25% off discount voucher, which Sebastian politely refused. But now he's popped up with this picture, and perhaps that's what he's had done. It certainly looks like it could be. So, as you say, over the season, we'll likely see a progression of a thatch growing where there wasn't one.
Well, it's interesting, Darren, isn't it? Because that once again, Sebastian Vettel is not afraid of being authentic or a little bit vulnerable. Yeah. Now, yeah. Some people will see that as a weakness in him, but he is what he is. You know, he's not afraid of coming across as, for example, having had some problems in the last couple of years. And yeah. I mean, his podcast that he did with Tom Clarkson, the F1 podcast, which I listened to before Christmas, you know, I just thought it was brilliant the way he came across everything that he said. He's at a different stage in his life, etc. He recognizes that. But on the follically challenged thing, two comments I'll make. One slightly amusing moment I remember early on when I was working for Autosport back in the 1980s, going to a press conference at the Austrian Grand Prix, and it was with Teo Fabi, who drove for the Benetton BMW team. And I'm sorry to say, but he had the most amazing comb over you have ever seen. I mean, he was complete. There was nothing there, but he had grown.
I forgot about Fabi. Yeah,
he'd grown like half a meter of hair and then dragged it across the top. And it was just the most extraordinary thing. And then and this isn't a serious point. I mean, we all know, I think everyone listening knows, you know, Eddie Jordan suffered from alopecia. So when I saw Sebastian Vettel turn up at the Silverstone-based Aston Martin team, I couldn't help think this is not the first time a follically challenged person has been looking for performance out of that team. And it didn't do Eddie any harm. And in Eddie's case, you know, it was an affliction. You know, he had a very serious accident. He lost his hair. He suffered from alopecia. His mother addressed that. Eddie's very happy to talk about it because it affected how he viewed himself. And I think it actually helped in some ways to create the personality of Eddie Jordan, that we see that kind of almost distract attention.
Deflects away, doesn't it?
It kind of deflects, exactly. I think a lot of the personality was created from that. So yeah, very authentic of Sebastian. And
you've got me thinking about it as well. Every clip of him I see, I'm going to be studying, like, does that look a millimeter longer or a millimeter, you know, is it a millimeter?
I may be wrong. I'm no expert in these things, fortunately, but it may come. But I have my suspicions from what I'd heard previously and from talking to Tomo earlier today. And I just echo what Mark said. I'm quite as a professional within the sport, like all of us, I certainly do try to kind of not be a fan, not be a super fan of these drivers, not be some kind of sycophant, which we see a lot in the paddock. But I'm quite a Vettel fan, not so much equally, I guess, what he does on the track is impressive, particularly in the Red Bull days. Obviously, he's had difficult times at Ferrari. But really, away from the sport, he seems such a grounded, into his family, got his classic motorbikes he looks after, and seems to have a kind of a basis in life that is very grown up. And a lot of drivers, especially as we get older and they seem to get younger, they don't seem to have, you know, and even someone like Lewis Hamilton, obviously he's 35, is he now? And yet to me seems a lot younger than 35 in many of his attitudes and his behavior. Whereas Sebastian seems like a kind of, he is an elder statesman, not the oldest, but I really respect the way that he is.
The great thing as well, I was thinking this morning, was there's obviously everyone's talking about it on social media, but Vettel probably has no idea because he doesn't have social media, which again, I quite like, you know, he's probably completely oblivious to it, doesn't care. So again, it kind of hits home exactly what you guys were saying, that he probably just turned up. He might not have even thought about it. He might have got in the car, you know, it's an exciting day, seat fit, new team.
Although if he has had the surgery, he does think about it.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. So we'll see. I mean, that will be interesting in itself to see what he was thinking when he did that. Because I guess it was a grand reveal to the world if he has had that surgery.
You've got your first question for your first press conference.
Oh gosh. I can already
I was thinking this as well this morning. I was thinking it's still a very interesting question. You know, if his hair is like that all season, I think it is, like you were saying, it shows a vulnerability that we don't see in a lot of drivers. So,
yeah,
quite an interesting topic. A guy at that stage of his career as well, going into a new challenge, has had difficult seasons, like you say. It's kind of a fascinating part to his story. And like you guys have said already, I think Vettel's kind of one of those guys you listen to when he talks about anything. Very grounded guy. So. Yeah. Interesting stuff.
I mean, something else about Sebastian, which I'll ask you all about, because I don't go to all the races anymore. I only go to 3 or 4 a year.
But one of the things that
you don't go to.
It's been far too long.
When we get back to normal, but the thing that I noticed from afar really is his relationship with Lewis, and that relationship seems very mature and quite balanced and actually sincere.
It's had its rocky stages, hasn't it? Of course.
Yeah, it has. But I thought it was interesting through 2020 watching, you know, whether it had to do with the pandemic and the impact it was having on everyone, plus Sebastian choosing to support Lewis on his campaigning and all those kind of things. But there were a few times I really thought that looks quite sincere. They seem to have a friendship. Actually a friendship. So Nate, is that something that you kind of see and observe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think definitely you're right that the last year, maybe 2 years, that's really been a thing. I think interestingly in 2017 and 2018, when they were kind of both vying for the title and Vettel had those mistakes, I remember at the time Lewis was saying some kind of nice things about Vettel that at the time sounded quite patronizing, because it was under that kind of microscope of, well, these two guys should be fighting for the championship and Vettel was making those mistakes. But I think you're absolutely right. I think that relationship behind the scenes, away from what we see, has really grown. And I think last year, I think Lewis really respected the fact that Vettel was so open with him when it came to, you know, kneeling before races, when it came to, you know, the things that Lewis was bringing into driver briefings and stuff like that. So I think that's nice to see. And we know that by contrast, Alonso and Vettel have this kind of icy relationship where at every opportunity, Alonso will just kind of say something to disparage Vettel. So I think it's nice when you have world champions who show that respect, and we don't have to wait 20 years until they're doing a documentary, you know, when they've retired. You know, we actually see it kind of while they're still driving. So I quite like that.
So are we going to have Fernando making a jibe about his follicle challenge? You know, is he going to say, is Fernando going to be bringing his hands through his mane of hair and saying, well, Seb, you know, you've obviously got a few challenges there as you're getting
a new sponsor like L'Oreal or someone.
Well, my first prediction is that Alonso's going to turn up with his hair as long as it can be, just perfectly greased back.
Great big fro.
Like flicking it. Yeah, doing the Zoolander looks, you know, all the poses to camera.
If I was still the Silverstone team, I'd be on the phone to Just for Men on Monday morning looking for a deal. You know, we'd ride the back of that Sebastian Vettel wave.
I wish you were still there. That would be a brilliant story. The chapter in the book, where I got a great sponsor. Da, 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 da. Talking about books, let's get on to our chat about Daniel Ricciardo. Now, Nate, I've teased it twice already, and it isn't really that good a tease, so I think I've overegged it. But tell us what the connection is. Why have I got you on to talk about Daniel Ricciardo?
Yeah, so I appreciate multiple plugs, by the way, Jenny. I was thinking this is crazy. I didn't expect to. So it was what turned out to be Daniel Ricciardo's final year at Red Bull was 2018. The start of that year, I was approached to contribute to kind of a coffee table book that was being put together, you know, write the words of his career up to that point. And the funny story was the publication of it got pushed back and delayed, and it actually came out, I think it was August 3rd it came out. And any diehard Ricciardo fan might remember that on August the 2nd that year, he announced he was going to Renault and leaving Red Bull. And so this book just came out plastered with images of him in Red Bull, me saying that, you know, one of the great things with the Red Bull program is it's his best chance to win a title anytime soon, all these things. I was thinking, oh man, this is such bad timing. I think it probably boosted the sales a little bit because people thought, well, I want to read about this guy. But it's always been a funny story I tell about it, that it literally could not have been more badly timed, unless it had come out the day before, maybe. But that was fun, you know, and it wasn't an official book, but in doing it, I spoke a lot to the Ricciardo camp and kind of was able to you know, forge some quite closer relationships with them, which, as you guys know, is always such a good way of just knowing what's going on with a driver, just kind of the attitude and the feeling around what they're doing, the moves they might be making and stuff like that. So it was a fun project with a kind of funny backstory.
I love that. Timing is everything, isn't it, in these cases? Is the book still available?
Yeah, so it's Daniel Ricciardo, In Pursuit of Greatness is the book, and you can still get it. It was delayed a bit. It's difficult to get your hands on because of COVID in some regions, but if you order it, you will get it eventually. It will be on a boat somewhere traveling to you at some speed. But
And Daniel is still obviously in pursuit of greatness, and the next chapter in this will be his move across to McLaren. Darren, when drivers move teams, often for you photographers who work so closely with certain teams, it can really disrupt the flow of things, but it can also be hugely exciting, maybe.
Yeah, absolutely. Change is a good thing, isn't it? I've always embraced that. And I think that drivers moving is something that creates excitement, especially as we're going into a season where to a greater degree, the cars are going to be almost exactly the same. There's going to be a few livery changes. Obviously, Dan's going to have a Mercedes behind him rather than a Renault. But other than that, you know, it's what you want to see is drivers moving and obviously Sainz going into the Ferrari. These kind of things, you know, shake it up a bit, give a little bit of interest where perhaps we're lacking a little bit generally at the moment.
Mark, I'm intrigued. How do these deals come about in the weird world of Formula One? Because it's not like football. You don't have a transfer window where all the deals kind of accumulate. So what does it look like for a driver? What does it look like for a team?
Drivers rely on management. And as Nate probably knows more detail than I do, there was a little bit of a kerfuffle over Daniel's management just as he was looking to move to Renault, and he has subsequently transferred across to having a much larger management company. Actually, he's also got a management company here in Australia who look after his affairs in Australia. And that kind of really showed where he was on a learning curve. And drivers do go on a learning curve outside of the cockpit as much as inside the cockpit. And I think as he came towards the end of his Red Bull racing time and all the things that were happening in terms of the dynamic in the team with Max Verstappen and whether Daniel felt that the team was really supporting him to the degree that he wanted, he could read the tea leaves in terms of what was happening there. I think on the other side, the whole business thing was kind of going through a period of change as well. And I mean, it's interesting when you see a driver change, you say, well, so you try to look at the reasons for that. Why has that driver gone to that team? Now, to be blunt, he wasn't going to Renault to win races. And he quickly came to that conclusion. The pursuit of excellence or the pursuit of success was being most definitely having the pause button pressed while he filled his bank account. And quite frankly, Cyril Abiteboul didn't see him coming or his management when they did that deal. And a driver who will remain nameless sat beside me on the plane shortly after Daniel signed for Renault and said to me, "It's shocking. I mean, he's cashed in. He's cashed his chips in way too early. This is a guy who should be winning more races and going for a world championship. He's cashing in." And I've thought about that conversation for the last, well, not the last 2 years, because it only took him a year to make his mind up that he wouldn't be staying at Renault very much longer. And so it's proven. So this move to McLaren looks like the move that he should have been doing away from Red Bull 2 years ago. The opportunity wasn't there. He has had a bit of an interim step, and now we'll see whether Daniel Ricciardo's legacy is going to be more Grand Prix victories and possibly, you know, challenging for, I don't know, top three in the championship, as opposed to just being a really super nice guy who you know, was great on social media, and yes, he won a few races at Red Bull, and I think he's got a much bigger legacy to leave in this sport.
I agree, and on the McLaren link, it's quite interesting because in 2018 it was really Renault and McLaren who were, by that summer, who were vying for his contract. His management originally obviously wanted the Mercedes link. And, you know, we know that Mercedes are happy to kind of string Bottas along on those deals. And I think there was suggestion that they might have been offered something similar where they get a one-year deal at Mercedes, which they said they didn't like. I've always doubted that because I don't know who would have turned down a Mercedes drive. So it sounded like that deal never actually materialized and it was the one they wanted. Zac Brown felt really confident he had Ricciardo in 2018. And if you think about where McLaren was back then, Ricardo just thought, I can't commit to this team in the state it's in right now. It needs to show the 2 years of upwards trajectory that we have seen since. So it is interesting that, you know, Ricardo's kind of gone back to that decision now and has joined the team that really Renault have been in direct competition with for the past two seasons. I think he's in a really good spot, you know, with those Mercedes engines coming in. McLaren have had to change their car more than any other team. Darren's right. Most of those cars are going to be more or less, not identical, but not changing enough to really dramatically change the performance. But the McLaren, they've just had to, just to, you know, fit a new power unit in there. So it's going to be interesting. And if there's any guy on the grid who you'd want to have there, if you can't get Lewis, if you can't get Alonso, you can't get Vettel, I think Ricciardo is the next guy, just proven performer in a good car, proven performer in a midfield car as well. So it's
you
going to be
better than Verstappen would be. It's interesting you left him out.
That was probably a Freudian slip. Verstappen I might put in there, but I think Ricciardo right now, I would put in that situation at McLaren. I think Verstappen might get irritated with that a lot quicker than Ricciardo. Ricciardo showed a lot of patience over the past two seasons. And that's not to disparage Verstappen's attitude.
We all show a lot of patience for those paychecks, wouldn't we?
That's true. Yeah, I think that is something worth thinking about as well.
Especially as last year, he didn't have to show any patience because he knows he's going to McLaren. It's kind of bizarre what we had last year in so many ways, but having, before the season started, I know it started in June, but before the wheels were turning, we knew so much about where the drivers were going to be for 21, which was... It was a bit of a very new situation. I can't think of many times in the past, off the cuff, I can't think of any right now, where you knew exactly that someone was going to be signing before the previous season had started. So, you know, we've kind of had this tease going on about what's it going to be like. And we see Sainz driving a Ferrari and he's probably thinking, oh my God, rather than stand with McLaren, which, as Nate says, is on an upward trajectory. Obviously, they're going to have teething troubles. I don't think it's going to be plain sailing. But, we'll see what Daniel can do with that, because I would have doubts that that his teammate, that Lando Norris, with his inexperience, as good as he is, as good as I believe he is, and will be even better, he's not the guy really to develop a car, is he? So there's a lot of pressure on Daniel to do that.
Lando and Daniel is going to be such a strong lineup. I think they will fundamentally get on with each other. They will get on with the team. The team will, I think, love that dynamic. I think that's the expectation. And there is something beautiful about being the challenger team. Everyone's expecting Mercedes to go out and win the championship, Red Bull to be, you know, run around in second place and hopefully winning some races and so on and so forth. On the basis of how Ricciardo was driving in 2020, I mean, he was driving brilliantly in that Renault and producing stunning results for Cyril. Just to get that tattoo was obviously such a massive motivation for Daniel to try and put one over on Cyril. But in all seriousness, driving brilliantly for Renault and then having this opportunity at McLaren. And we all saw what happened when... you know, Honda gave up on Formula One and Braun stuck a Mercedes in the back of that car and then went, it wasn't the engine, it was the diffuser. But my point was that the engine...
It was both, wasn't it? Because the diffuser wouldn't have worked without the power of the Mercedes.
Exactly. And the engine change did help. And in a sporting world, not just Formula One, in all sport, where everyone talks about incremental gains and all the small little bits add up to a competitive advantage, the whole thing feels like a good step for McLaren off the back of what was already a strong year. So as the challenger team, the challenger brand, you know, they couldn't wish to have a greater lineup. I think it's very exciting.
I loved the Sainz-Norris kind of dynamic we had. I still didn't think it was, we didn't know just how good Sainz was. And so, but, you know, by extension, we don't quite know how good Norris is. Whereas you put Ricciardo in there, the proven race winner who's done it in different machinery. This really, you know, if Lando's right up there like he was with Sainz, you know, right, this guy really is as good as he's looked. But also for Norris, it gives him that chance to kind of raise his game, similar to Sainz with Leclerc at Ferrari. Both those guys have a chance to kind of kick on and really test themselves against a much more experienced opponent.
And how do you think that he will do? I would imagine, personally, that Leclerc will destroy Sainz with a few, obviously, occasionally Sainz will get the better of him, especially in maybe in time management, that kind of thing. But I would imagine Lando is going to get quite a shock, maybe.
Early in the year, I think it will be more on the Ricciardo side. And I would see that the first year Norris and Sainz were together, Norris closed that gap over the year. And he's quite good at doing that. He's quite good at noticing where he's kind of lacking to another driver. It's actually quite impressive for a guy that we always just assume likes playing his video games and kind of likes messing around behind the scenes. The more into his F1 career he's got a bit more professional about things. So I can see that gap closing up.
Yeah. And it's noticeable that did I read recently that he said that he wants to present a more grown up image, for want of a generic term, with his social media, with his kind of slightly clowning about, which I always think is, you know, perception is all, and you want to kind of lose that as you move on, especially if you're going to start going up against one of the bona fide superstars.
So I have a little bit of a thing about contemporary PR in Formula One, which is PR departments, marketing departments, getting drivers to do things like, I remember Red Bull Racing getting, I think it was Daniel and Max, they got them to see how many marshmallows they could eat in 60 seconds. And I remember watching that video and everyone was saying, ha, isn't it amazing? It's going viral. And I'm thinking, I would love to have been the PR person who called Ayrton Senna and Alain Prost into a room and said, we want to see how many marshmallows you could eat in 60 seconds. The response would have been incredibly brief.
They would have left the room.
And so I actually think that in the headlong rush to embrace, you know, the kids on social media, the PR and marketing departments have, to some extent, diluted the worth of their Grand Prix drivers. And instead of them making them sort of these aspirational heroes, they've tried to change the dynamic to the point where, yes, you now have people like Daniel Ricciardo and Lando Norris saying, oh, but I'm serious about this. I'm actually serious about my career. The PR should be supporting the fact that they are serious professional Formula One drivers. But they're really good.
It's fantastic, fantastic, Mark, to hear you say that, because it's easy for us people of a becoming a vintage generation in the sport that you know, we've known each other a long time, but you can come across as sour and dour and a bit boring and overly serious. But that's what you've outlined is exactly my thoughts. You know, another funny video on Channel 4's coverage of Sainz and Daniel mucking about, or, you know, of Lando playing the fool, you know, and I don't mean that in a nasty way. I just mean it's the way it's presented. And
it, isn't that like the youth of today? That's what they want, is it? That's
is it? I don't know, Jenny. I'm not youth. I don't know, but I can only judge it on my 10 and 12 year old boys, who the only driver that one of my children, they've got a father whose life revolves around this sport and always has, and it's, you know, it's paid for everything in their lives, my coverage of it. But the only driver that gets my youngest son excited is Max Verstappen, because Max is kind of aggressive and doesn't give a you know what, and he's in a Red Bull car. I think that helps, because he associates Red Bull with being kind of cool. And it's interesting. He's not interested in the larking about and the marshmallow eating. That's not what he's interested in. He wants to see people driving flat out, wheel banging, and I'm going to win this damn race. And I like that.
If you look at one of the silver linings to the COVID pandemic for Formula One, you know, I watched the evolution of the esports sort of phenomenon, which was already there but has accelerated during the global pandemic. And although I'm not an esports racer, I watched it. I went on Twitch. I was watching the drivers and I thought, now, actually, that's authentic. So actually watching Charles Leclerc and George Russell having a bit of a laugh together and with all these fans engaged with them, that was absolutely fantastic way to engage with the younger audiences, you know, as they call them, Gen Z or millennials. You know, that's great. Absolutely wonderful to do that. But I think the larking about PR, to me, they very often just fall over the edge into being clowning. And we don't have clowns driving Formula One cars at 350 kilometers an hour. They are athletes. They are having to take huge risks, and we are expecting them to excel. And, you know, I think it's quite noticeable that Lewis Hamilton doesn't do that kind of thing. Now, I don't think Bradley Lord would think of asking Lewis Hamilton to eat marshmallows in 60 seconds. But
they're not vegan, so it's tricky.
You could probably find some that are, though.
But you know, good point. But the thing is that Lewis is an adult, seven times world champion. And that's, you know, and Sebastian is like that as well. And so I think, you know, again, it's really interesting to see how the positioning of the drivers in social media and mainstream media is handled.
It's interesting you bring that up because, and you mentioned earlier, Ricardo switching from his old agent to CAA Sports. And one of the reasons behind that was that he felt there was, I suppose, a bit of media that beyond Lewis wasn't really being tapped into. So I don't know if you saw last year, but he had a great interview with GQ magazine, which is not something you usually see F1 drivers on. You know, he's been on the Trevor Noah show in the US. So with Ricardo and CAA Sports, there's been a real attempt to try and kind of break him into some of those kind of, I suppose, Lewis Hamilton kind of niche areas where you go away from being the funny, jovial F1 driver, which is difficult because that is what Daniel Ricciardo is known for being. But it is interesting. So I think that you are seeing that kind of the reaction away from that. And that's why Ricciardo and Norris, to me, from a marketing standpoint, will be so interesting. Because while I think Ricciardo will play that game, I think he's already very much in that sense of like, I don't want to be known as, you know, the funny guy that wins a couple of races, never wins a championship.
I think we saw it last year. I think not only was he driving superbly, but he was better off track, wasn't he? He was more mature, if you like. Did come across that way.
Yeah, and even little things like, you know, with the shoey, he forgot the first time he did it. You know, it wasn't the first thing he thought wasn't to kind of do the silly shoey stuff. And it's not to say that he shouldn't do fun stuff because, you know, he is genuinely, you know, just kind of a fun guy to be around. And clearly people, you know, love that about him. But I think there is definitely a point where it becomes detrimental to what you're trying to achieve on the racetrack. So it is an interesting one to watch and see which one has the rub on the other one, whether Norris influences Ricciardo that way or whether Ricciardo kind of brings out a more serious side of Norris.
So the question is, okay, both questions, where do you think he'll finish the championship? How many wins? You can play along at home. Let us know in the comments section. Let's start with Darren.
Given that the two Mercedes will be ahead of him, I would imagine Leclerc. I would imagine that the two Red Bulls will be ahead. I'll go for an optimistic six.
And how many race wins?
Oh, sorry. No, none.
None. Oh, ouchie. Okay, Mark, let's go to you next.
This is really boring. I was going to say exactly the same as Darren. I don't think he'll finish in the top five. And I certainly don't believe he'll win a Grand Prix. I think Vettel will win a Grand Prix for Aston Martin because it's now the...
I hope so.
Because it's now the Mercedes Junior team. And on a day when Mercedes trip up, particularly if it's a power circuit, I think that team's performance will be pretty mighty. So I probably shouldn't tell you all this, but I've actually got a little bet on that Vettel will win in Spa. So there we go.
What odds have you got for that? I'm intrigued now.
Well, I'm not telling you, but it's with a good pal of mine. We actually a guy who used to work at Honda, oddly enough. So he came to me and he said, "I've got this opportunity." And he said, "You know, what do you reckon?" And I said, "Vettel, yeah, Spa, bit of an Andrew Green special that circuit. His cars tend to go quite well there over the years."
Given what Mark said, I completely forgot about Aston Martin, so I'll drop him to eighth.
Oh, wow. God. Okay, so you put me down as the optimistic sixth and Darren is the negative eighth.
Nate, come on, he can do better than that.
Yeah, I'm going to buck the trend. So I'm going to say that he finishes fifth. I think obviously we have Mercedes and Red Bull. I think Perez will do a much better job than Albon, so that covers those top four. And I do think Aston Martin are going to, at times, really challenge those top two teams. But in Lance Stroll and Vettel, from a form perspective, I can't see that pairing always getting the best out of that package. Whereas with Ricciardo, I think that one thing he did with Renault really well was even when there wasn't a great result there, he was still finishing fifth, sixth, seventh, really getting the most out of that. And over the course of a season, and we saw that with Perez, funnily enough, the guy who left Aston Martin, you know, he missed two races and still, based on incredible consistency, was able to finish quite high up. So I'll say fifth just as well because it's fun to buck the trend. And why not? I'll say he'll win a race as well somewhere. You know, we'll get some rain, we'll get a bit of drama, we'll get, you know, Lewis, something happens with Lewis, something happens with Max. And yeah, Ricciardo has shown quite a lot that when he gets that sniff of a win or a podium, it's like he kind of levels up. You know, if you play video games and your guy kind of levels up at a good point in the game, he seems to do that quite a lot. So hopefully he gets that chance and we get to see it because, Yeah, I could see him winning a race. But same with Vettel as well. I think Vettel could win one. In fact, I'm gonna rush to the bookies straight after this and put a bet down on Mark's advice.
You might have to do it online. I think all the bookies are closed in this country. True. But there we go. I feel like Daniel has a fantastic opportunity going to that team. And everybody might think I'm crazy for this, but I think he's probably got, let's say we get 23 races away. Never going to happen. But I think he's got the chance of at least 3 race wins.
Oh, wow.
And I think he can finish fourth.
So which of the top...
If he gets 3 race wins, he'll be having Zach Brown's love child in a year's time.
Okay, so we've got to watch Vettel's hair.
What a ghastly thought.
Zach Brown's love child potential with Ricciardo. It's just terrifying. I never knew this show was going to get quite so real. Okay, so we discussed Ricciardo. There's one last thing that we need to talk about very briefly, and it's the Hamilton situation. He still hasn't signed a contract. We're careering towards the start of the season. Mark, what's going on in your mind? Why hasn't Hamilton signed with Mercedes yet?
Well, it's clearly to do with money, and I think it's to do with money in terms of Toto will have made him a firm offer and said, that's it. And then there's everything else. And the everything else is really important, because if Toto doesn't want to move above a certain ceiling, and then the whole terms around the contract become really important, because Lewis has had quite a lot of freedom already. He now will have an opportunity to ask for even more freedom, to go and earn more money doing other things. And I'll give you a little statistic, which I had from the horse's mouth. In Michael Schumacher's first year of retirement after Ferrari, okay, when he had won his 7 titles, first year after Ferrari, he earned 25.6 million euros in his first year after he stopped racing. And that's 15 years ago. So that shows you the potential for Lewis to earn a great deal of money from endorsements and advertising programs and, you know, all the other things that he's already involved in. And if you think about the fact that he's already been endorsing vote and advertising Vodafone, he's been working with LG, got a number of other companies. I did an event with him last year with a large information technology company. And so the opportunity for Lewis to make up whatever the salary negotiation is, that comes down to how much freedom he gets. And the freedom isn't just about how many days he doesn't need to spend with Mercedes-Benz in Formula One. The freedom comes down to, for example, him being able to work with companies that might be borderline conflict with some of Mercedes-Benz partners. Because at the moment, you know, his contract will say he absolutely can't do anything with any company that is in any shape or form a conflict with Mercedes-Benz. So this is where he really needs to negotiate the overall terms of the deal. There's one other thing which I'm going to refer to, and actually it was David Coulthard who discussed this with me last year. And David discussed it with me in relation to Sebastian Vettel. So you remember when Vettel didn't get the offer from Ferrari and found himself out of a drive? Well, one of the things I remember DC saying to me was, this is the problem when you don't have management. So drivers very often get to a stage in their career where they think they know it all, and they've been through a number of hoops in terms of working with the big management company, CAA and IMG. And they get to a point where they want to do it themselves. So they get a little group of people around them. Normally they employ a lawyer or maybe their best friend and a couple of other people. And that's kind of where Lewis is at. And the point that DC made to me, and I remember thinking it was very well made, was that you absolutely have to have top level professional management looking after your negotiations. Don't do it yourself. Don't try to do it yourself. Don't try to build your own management around you, because they will tell you what you want to hear. And DC said that one of the reasons he had Martin Brundle look after him was that he said Martin would phone me and tell me home truths. He said periodically Martin would phone me and say, DC, you're not as good as you think you are. The market's changing. You need to read the tea leaves. And in fact, I've read them for you, and this is what you need to do. And David said, particularly in relation to when he ended his contract at McLaren, DC was confident he was going to get another drive. It was Martin Brundle who said to him, actually, DC, you're not going to get another drive. You're going to have to work bloody hard to keep your career going in Formula One. And he ended up writing to every single team until eventually he got an offer to come to Jaguar, which then became Red Bull Racing, and then he continued his career there. But the point is that the lessons are the same. you must never overestimate your position as a driver. You have to have external professional management. And I think it's just looking at what's happened, it's a weakness for Lewis that we are now at the end of January and he still hasn't signed a contract.
How do you think it's going to play out then? What would your, if you were having a bet with your mate who's the bookie, what would you have your money on? Yeah.
Okay, so this is, I mean, this is based on nothing other than, you know, my gut feeling and having seen this. I have a horrible feeling that Lewis is going to agree to the deal that Toto has effectively outlined for him. They will put pen to paper, they will sign that deal. But the damage of the negotiations will have damaged the relationship. And there is a real danger when that happens, because the moment a driver and a team boss who previously got on well together come out of a tense negotiation with any kind of change to that relationship, it's funny how things can go pear-shaped then pretty quickly.
I was going to say, Jenny, you've spent a lot of time interviewing Lewis and Toto over the years. So what do you make of it, where those both are and kind of the way that they've approached it? Because I think there's definitely, as Mark says, like a kind of these two guys are kind of standing their ground and won't concede to the other one, which is fascinating given how close their relationship is or has been before this.
But I find it fascinating because obviously I haven't been in a face-to-face interview with either Toto or Lewis for over a year now. I haven't looked into their eyes, and looking into someone's eyes tells you so much more than just the interview, just the words that they say, their body language, reading the whole package of who they are. And that's the bit I'm really missing by not being in a paddock. And I wonder if that's part of the issue with what's happening with this deal and with a relationship between Toto and Lewis. You know, we all know the story that last time they did the contract, you know, they spent a day talking about it and then they shook hands, went out for pizza, or got pizza, and everything was great in the world. Well, they can't do that at the moment. Lewis had COVID at the end of the season, then Toto got coronavirus in January. The whole thing is slowed down, it's strained. They can't get in a room and just hammer things out. They've got to do it via Zoom. And we all know that, you know, if we were sat around a table right now, the four of us, we'd have a conversation. It might be slightly different to this, because you can pick up on the body language of each other. You can read much more into a situation than looking at a tiny screen on a computer. So I feel that COVID has had a massive part to play in this negotiation, the stumbling blocks that they seem to be finding, and the questions that Lewis has asked himself over the last few months, which have only come about really from his growth and maturity in BLM and being more aware of the world, and from having COVID. So I wish I could tell you what, you know, by looking in their eyes, what's going on. I don't know. But clearly there is something more to this situation, because let's face it, everybody's normally signed a contract. Daniel Ricciardo signed a contract this time last year.
Yeah.
I have to say, I think for me, it's the first time that I've really felt the Niki Lauda factor is missing. If Niki Lauda was still around, you know, one of two things would have happened. Either Niki would have phoned Lewis and said, "You're talking crap. This isn't going to happen. This is what you need to do." And Lewis would have listened to Niki. And equally, if Niki felt that Toto's offer was not good enough, he'd say the same to Toto. He'd say, "Toto, listen, we got up the amount here. Come on, we got to get this deal done." And you know, and if Toto's listening, Toto, that's not to say that you were beholden to Niki, but I mean, both Lewis and Toto have been at pains to say how much they miss the dynamic of Niki Lauda in that team. And there was never a better person to have in the middle of a negotiation like this, particularly a negotiation with all of the complexity around it, including COVID, as you say, Jenny, including the fact that Lewis has just tied up his seventh world championship. So on top of the fact he's a new Concorde agreement and a budget cap and a potential cap on driver salaries and all those good things. Lots of complexity around this. I think Niki might have gone straight to the jugular in terms of getting some decision.
I absolutely agree. I think you can just imagine him banging their heads together and sort it out, guys. You know, and it wouldn't have run on this long. It probably would have been sorted out early last year or middle of last year. I'm just thinking about the offer that they've made. Lewis Hamilton will obviously have in his mind what he's worth, which is obviously a percentage more than he was getting in his previous contract. Toto will have an idea. Maybe there's some pressure, and we hear stuff about how Toto's relationship is with the board and those kind of things. I know he's re-signed, I think it's for another 5 years, but there were obviously something going on behind the scenes. Maybe there's pressure in that sense. Maybe there's pressure in the kind of divisive politics that Hamilton has brought into the sport, if you like. You know, it's a marketing game. Mercedes want to sell cars, and you know, these kind of things can be positive, can be negative. And I just wonder if it's just, as well as what you've said, Mark, and as well as Lauda not being around, all these things have kind of come on top of, as you said, Jenny, them both getting COVID, them both not being able to sit in a room, because that's what we can't do these days. They would have had to do it like we're doing, which is kind of, you know, it's nice, but it's a bit impersonal. Or, you know, you can get, when you send emails to people, you can obviously get the wrong end of the stick, you know, and it's, they're human beings at the end of the day. And there's something not right, because as Mark says, and as we're all thinking, they really should have signed and have everything nailed down by now.
At the end of last year, you'd have thought, well, Lewis has all the leverage here because he's just won a seventh championship. He can say, I'm the guy, you know, everyone knows Lewis Hamilton is a racing driver, you know, even if they're not a racing fan. But I think Toto Wolff has much more leverage in this discussion than people are letting on, because he can turn to Lewis and say, look, you've got a gift-wrapped eighth championship here. I mean, let's be honest, it would take something pretty monumental for Lewis not to win the title this year. And that is a massive bargaining tool as well for Mercedes, because they can say, well, look, it's not like we're paying you this extra money to go win us that eighth title. You know, and I massively respect Lewis. I'm not trying to say it's all down to the car, but he's in a position where he should win that championship. So I think that added into all of the things that we've been talking about, it probably is why Toto Wolff hasn't moved. And we know that Toto Wolff is a massive pragmatist. You know, he will do what he thinks is best for the race team as well. And I've kind of just been thinking about this week. Like, how many times do you think he's looked at his phone and seen like 8 missed calls, Fernando Alonso, you know, over this past couple of weeks, where Fernando's like, well, maybe there's a chance here for me to get back in. I don't think that will happen, obviously. But my take on it is that they'll get it signed. I think that this is kind of the way that their relationship seems to play out. And I think what Mark said about what it does to the relationship afterwards is really fascinating, because we weren't sure whether Toto Wolff was going to stay with the team this year. And we know that he is now for the next couple of seasons. And I think that might have played in. I know Lewis wanted him to stay, but now Toto Wolff is staying, it might have changed his priorities going forward and stuff like that. So it's going to be really interesting to see. I still think he stays. I still think Lewis wins the championship, but I think that was quite a shrewd point Mark made about the bigger impact of this will be seen, you know, a couple of years down the line, when they come to do the next one, or when they come to decide what to do with George Russell.
Surely it's going to be the last one. It'll be the last one for Hamilton, surely.
You'd think so, but again, it depends on how good a car he gets. If he gets another great car and he gets to this spell again,
well, it's going to be the same as last year, so it's going to be a rocket ship.
And
I totally agree with you that he'll.
Yeah.
I wouldn't bet against Mercedes. My money would certainly be on them to be the ones who make the most of it. We know with the hybrid era that they were working 3 years before anyone else was on what they were going to do. Yeah. I don't think they would have dropped the ball this time. But I absolutely agree with you on that he's the only person who's going to win the world title, which I think plays against the sport. I first noticed it in, was it French Grand Prix 2019? You start getting all these social media stuff. It was a complete cakewalk. One of the dullest, I hate saying that about Formula One, but one of the dullest races for a long time. And I was working at it. But you were aware of that. And suddenly there started to become a negative PR to winning. It was just too much. They were just winning too much. And obviously we've had last year, we know what's going to happen whenever the season starts and however many races there will be this year that Hamilton will win. It's just a case of where he confirms his record-breaking title. And Mercedes, I think there's a danger that they look like they're just a vehicle for Hamilton's relentless, successful campaign.
Nate, I think, you know, your point is very well made when you say no disrespect to Lewis Hamilton's talent. We all know what a superb driver he is, but you are right. Toto Wolff holds the cards here. He's got the best team in Formula One. He's got the best car in Formula One. And to Darren's point, when you have those board meetings at Mercedes-Benz, when, you know, Toto turns up for the board meeting at Mercedes-Benz and they're all sitting around the table, I suspect they have the board level equivalent of the you know, that fan question, is it the car or is it the driver? And I think Mercedes by now, no, it's the car. You know, our car will win the championship. So do we really need to pay this guy the money he's asking for to drive for us yet again and win an eighth world championship? And there is a big economic point here as well, which is that we're about to find out in the coming weeks the extent of the financial catastrophe for Liberty and Formula One of the 2020 season. And everyone thought that was going to be an isolated catastrophic season financially. We're now going to have another catastrophic season financially. I did an event a couple of months ago with three of the race promoters, Stuart Pringle, Silverstone, François de Montier from Montreal, and Sheikh Khalifa from Bahrain. Only Bahrain were saying they could weather this storm. Silverstone were saying it's been a complete catastrophe and we have to have a normal British Grand Prix in 2021, otherwise we are in serious trouble. Canada were saying if we don't have a Grand Prix in June 21, we are completely out of business. We can't survive 2 years without a Canadian Grand Prix. So when you look at the profound economic impact of COVID on the automotive industry, an automotive industry that's trying to electrify at a rate of knots, spend every dollar they can on research and development into further hybridization, battery and hydrogen. And then Lewis Hamilton's pitching up with whatever his request is. You can imagine quite a hard-nosed conversation has then developed as a result of those economic discussions. And therefore, I agree with you, Nate. I think Toto is sitting there with the ace card, and I suspect Lewis has not been too impressed with the fact that he's been told this is the deal, and is Niki Lauda's not been there to soften the blow.
Fascinating, it really is. And I mean, we'll have to watch this space basically and see what happens going into this season. We can only hope that it's a good season for everybody and that we get enough races away to make sure that all those promoters and all the circuits survive this very strange time. Darren, Mark, Nate, thank you so much for your time. It's lovely to see you. I know it's probably bedtime now where you are, Darren, and it's not far off for you, Mark, is it?
It's beer time, actually, here. We don't have a beer, I think.
In COVID, it's always beer time.
I was going to say beer time has become a very blurry, murky time.
Yeah. Very good. It's gone from beer time somewhere in the world to it's actually beer time everywhere in the world now.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right. Well, stay safe, everybody. Thank you for your time and we'll see you soon.